Welcome to the Toffee Blues, your source for all things Everton, and welcome to another show where once again I'm joined by Teddy McAllister. How are you doing, Teddy, first of all?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks, mate. How about yourself?
Yeah, pretty decent. Obviously, in spite of all the confusion that's been instilled in us in the past 4 or 5 days since the amazing announcement that was brought out on Sunday.
Yeah, it was like an Boris Johnson channeled us in a Roberto Martinez, didn't he? Just waffling for a long time but not actually saying anything at all.
Well, that's it. I think I'm not sure what was more ponderous, the Martinez's build-up play or Martinez's speeches weren't too bad. I think it was more Marco Silva-esque, if you ask me.
Well, Marco Silva just talk into his chest and mumble, didn't he? And Roberto Martinez would be the one who'd just lay it on thick, like, you know, talking about phenomenal performances after we'd lose 2-0 to Hull or someone like that. Boris Johnson on Sunday night, everyone, because all the little leaks and little tidbits that have been in the press and on social media building up to it, going, oh, what's, you know, there's going to be a change in this, you know, in the lockdown and what we're going to do, and watched it, and it was just so. It was just as clear as mud. Like, you know, you can do this, you can do that, but not if, you know, the sun's at this angle and not if, you know, the sky's blue. And it's just confusing. It's going to lead to people not being sure of what they can and can't do. And
well, that's already been seen. You've seen people getting on the buses in London and the tube and the state of it down there. And I mean, obviously, that's where the most people is as well. So, you're opening a seriously bad can of worms just there alone, but obviously that's happening all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, there will always be people who don't act responsibly, but on the other hand as well, you're always going to have them, so you've got to make it for the people who are going to be responsible. We're going to make it as clear and easy to follow as possible, and when it's not clear and it's not easy to follow, then you're exacerbating the problem. So I can't even blame the majority of people, because it's not clear what we're not meant to be doing, what we are meant to be doing, what we're not meant to be doing. And
I think the thing is, obviously, everybody wants to go back to normal, but when people aren't given any clarity, they're just going to go and do what they want, and we'll see that now. I mean,
if you say you've got to go back to work unless you can work from home, so that's a whole lot of people who need to go back to work. Now the option to not go has been taken off them on national television by the Prime Minister. But they've also said, well, you can't, you know, but don't use public transport and don't do this and don't do that. So it's made it really difficult for people. Like, what are they meant to do? Like, a lot of people don't want to, you know, come out of lockdown just yet. They don't feel at the time. But they've got no choice because, they've been told they can go back to work. But then they're also, they've got to put themselves at risk by travelling. It's just, I mean, it is difficult. But
I think the thing is, in the midst of all, obviously the furlough's been extended till the end of September. But like you say, there's so many contradictions. People think they're breaking the rules whichever way they turn.
Yeah, that's because the rules aren't clear. It's just simple as that, isn't it? But I mean, just hopefully, you know, we are over the worst of it now and we can start to progress, because it's not even about getting back to normal at this point. It's just about, you know, lowering the death toll, because the reason the lockdown's getting eased is not because they've beat the virus, it's because there's room in intensive care now. It's the grim reality of it. So just hope everyone can stay safe as much as possible.
That's it. I think you'll probably be able to second me on this when I say that it's in everyone's best interest to keep staying at home as much as you can. If there's any possibility that you can't go back to work, I'd take that option, because the more people we can keep at home, the more chance we've got of stopping it spreading.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just good luck to everyone in their own situations. I mean, it's no one's got it easy at the minute. But anyway, I think everyone's a little bit sick of the coronavirus. Let's get on to the football, shall we?
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, I think usually when we start these kind of shows, it's usually what have you been watching, such a thing, and we've just gone like completely dreary there. So yeah, we'll get on to the first show, and it's tonight it's going to be a Remember the Name segment, and tonight is going to be on the brief Everton career of Sam Mofo. We've then got the first two of our series of player reviews that we're going to be starting for the current season, which is of course not necessarily cancelled yet, but given how any possible resumption of the season will probably feel completely different, we are going to start our season reviews anyway, and the first two of them are coming up as well. The segments are going to be separate on YouTube, so we'll introduce them respectively as we move on anyway. And without further ado, we will get on with it, and we are going to look back on the fleeting Everton career of one of this century's most decorated players, the three-time Champions League winner Samuel Eto'o. Of course, only had 6 months at Everton, but still a lot to discuss about the fact that he ended up here in the first place. And I'm joined by Terry McAllister to go through it all, of course. Terry, on a scale of 1-2, we're going to win the league. How excited were you when we signed Samuel Eto'o in August 2014?
I wouldn't go as far as to say we're going to win the league, but I was very excited because, obviously, nobody thought for a second we were getting prime Samuel Eto'o. But he had come to the Premier League with Chelsea. He had, you know, gave a good account of himself. And we needed a striker. At the time, Romelu Lukaku was the cemented number one, you know, striker at the club. We just bought him as well. The money invested and the confidence invested showed he was going to be our man for the coming years. But the manager Martinez himself said at the time, like, when you play one up front, which we did, you need three strikers of different profiles. Obviously, but your main striker, and then we had a Runa Kone for whatever he was worth. And we needed another one. So obviously, we were in the market for a striker. And if you look at some of the other strikers who moved in that window, you know, the likes of Ricky Lambert went to Liverpool. And there wasn't like a lot of top quality players moving about. And then out of nowhere, we signed Samuel Eto'o, the same Samuel Eto'o who used to rip up the Champions League for Barcelona. Every single African Cup of Nations, he was the top scorer. It was just surreal. It was an absolute superstar name signing for the club. And we did similar a few years later with Wayne Rooney, because we had that intimate connection with Wayne Rooney and he'd come through our academy. It didn't feel like we were signing a sort of veteran, world-class player when we signed Rooney. It just felt like we were signing Rooney back.
He'd been here before as well.
Yeah, whereas it didn't have that sort of, you know, glittering sort of side to it, whereas Eto'o, I think, definitely did. People knew that he was, you know, approaching the sort of tail end of his career, but still Samuel Eto'o. I don't think people could get over it. I mean, I certainly couldn't get over that we'd signed him. I mean, he was going to line up in an Everton shirt.
Well, that was it. I think, obviously, we talk about the position of Runa Kone took up in the team, but he also took Eto'o's trademark number 9 shirt and meant he had to wear the number 5, which, you know, didn't go down well with you, did it, Terry?
No, I mean, this striker's wearing number 5 is just not on, is it? Like, that was the only wrinkle in it, that we gave him a dodgy shirt.
We signed one of the most iconic players of his generation who's worn number 9 everywhere he's been, and we have to give him number 5 because we've given it to Kone.
I know. I mean, I don't wear the replica tops. I mean, I might start if they ever make one in my size, but the shirt that year, it was my favourite shirt, like, possibly ever for Everton. And I remember thinking at the time, if I was to ever buy a shirt just to have, it'd be this one, that Eto'o on the back, but I just couldn't, number 5. I just couldn't. It was just too offensive to me sensibilities.
That's the only positive of Eto'o wearing number 5 is that you got to save yourself 40 to 50 quid.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, I mean, it was exciting. You know, he came in and he was going to come in and sort of, I don't think anyone expected him to provide competition for Lukaku, but he would complement Lukaku. You know, like, he'd play alongside him sometimes. He'd play, you know, he'd come in for him off the bench. You know, there'd be some games where he would start ahead of him, you know, to rotate and all. This was the perfect thing. We've got this young, up-and-coming striker who's our main man, but then we've also got that experienced head who can, you know, come in and see games out, come in and, you know, add a little bit of extra, like, nous into a game, can, you know, sort of teach the younger striker how to, you know, a few of his career lessons. And it just, it felt like a really good fit. I mean, Kone at that point had been injured for so long, he didn't even come into the equation. So I think it was just a case of we knew we had two strikers. One was Lukaku, one was Eto'o, and it felt like it was going to be a good combination. What followed is obviously what we'll touch on now, but I was so excited in that summer.
Of course, he came in this very first game. He scored a goal as well, didn't he? We lost 5-3 to Chelsea, 6-3. He scored one of the goals, obviously his former team as well. That was a really a bizarre game looking back. Like it's one of those games that if we didn't get beat, Everton would definitely be rerunning that now on YouTube on the little live rewatches, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean that was the first sort of one of the first indicators that about was going to go in the next two seasons with Roberto Martinez. Obviously, we were all walking on air with them at that point. You know, going into the second season, we did a fantastic year the season before, and we were in Europe now. And as we were saying, signed players like Eto'o. But this game sort of encapsulated them, like shipping goals for fun, but also still being all right in attack. It seemed like an anomaly at the time, but
especially after years of David Moyes, it was a bit of a shock to everybody's system. This game, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean we'd see more of that going forward, but no one was as upset. I don't remember at this time because it just seemed like a bizarre game. You know, we shipped six goals, no one's happy about that, but we'd scored three and the new signing had scored and you know, those Bezic's mistake, but it was a sign of things to come, like the poor defence under this manager, you know, against the discipline that had been put in by Moyes, which he'd sort of lent on the season before and started to go. But Eto'o scored, and did he score again before Burnley, the Burnley game?
He did. He scored in the Europa League at Krasnodar, which of course that was very interesting again because if I'm not mistaken, he played for Anzhi in Russia before he came to the Premier League with Chelsea, and I think he suffered a bit of racist abuse over there off Krasnodar fans. So it was a bit of an interesting scenario for him to go back there and obviously scored the goal. I think it was a 1-1 draw, wasn't it?
Do you know, I can't remember. I can only remember that I didn't go, but how far away it was. And like it was hours and hours away, wasn't it, on flights and everything? Like
I'm only thinking it's a draw because I remember the game, I think, and I think we played horrifically and we were getting beat. And I think he scored the late equaliser, and I think I was just relieved we got the draw because we went there and they battered us, to be honest. And again, that was a sign of what might have happened just a few months down the line in Kiev, which the less we talk about that, the better.
Yeah, well, let's see, wasn't around for that, so we'll not go into that in this episode.
I think Samuel Eto'o will be very glad he wasn't around for that as well. But obviously, he got that goal as well, and then he was starting to get into the team a bit more. We go to Burnley, and I think that's probably the pinnacle, obviously, of his time at Everton. Scored twice. One of them was an absolute peach as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the thing, that Burnley game aside, we squandered Eto'o, I think. Like, when we brought him in, I touched on it before, I had like an idea of how he might not be used. Like, substitute, play some games, you know, in that sort of Naismith role. You know, at the time we were playing Barkley as the number 10, and Naismith had just slotted around, like it was, you know, 4-2-3-1, and Naismith had just fit around that three behind the striker at different times, like sometimes on the left, sometimes on the right, sometimes he'd be behind. And I thought he will be another type of player like that. He won't be out wide, he won't be, you know, we were not going to play a 4-4-2. It just wasn't what we did. So, now we've moved on to it. But until recently, I never thought any manager would do that at Everton. It just wasn't in vogue. But I did think he'd play in that sort of 10 role as a shadow striker, because we did do that with Naismith.
Mm-hmm.
Never did. I always felt like Martinez didn't know how to use that too. Like, instead of playing him in games at Goodison Park, we were going to have most of the ball and we were going to have, you know, strong sort of stamp on the game where he's going to get freedom, he's going to get, you know, time and space because the other team are going to be sitting in a more defensive setup. He'll play him then. But the away games where we're going to be you know, being more compact, more of a team, more defensive, more structured, he won't play him as much in that, apart from off the bench. But it was the opposite that was true. He was, instead of playing him off Lukaku at home where he'll get time, he was playing him out wide, away from home, where you're just going to get nothing from him. Like, you know, playing him on wide right and wide left to get away to, you know, these Alaus teams. It's like, yeah, Samuel Eto'o in his prime would rinse any team like that. But at this point in his career, we just weren't getting the most out of him. It was just testament to Martinez, really.
It was one of those. I think the Burnley game where he scored those two goals, I think that was the one time he was used in that 10 role, wasn't he? I think Barkley was actually out on the left that game and he used Eto'o through the middle, and obviously he got two goals from in the middle of the pitch, funnily enough, like in the middle of the box, and one from the middle, like of the D outside the box.
His quality shone through. Like, obviously, we had Ross Barkley and he was going to be our number 10, but we were in the Europa League. We had plenty of games where we could have, you know, rotated and used, like, different combinations of players, or like you say, put Barkley out wide for the odd game with an overlapping fullback. You know, Baines was a lot younger then, and you know, we had Coleman on the other side, and they were both in their pomp. They were both tearing it up, out the two fullbacks. We had loads of things we could have done, and just Martinez never done it.
He really struggled that second season, I think, to kick us on. He really missed a massive opportunity to help us kick on, and maybe, obviously, with the European competition as well. I think he's done quite well in Europe, but he just misused all the players, like you say.
We did well in Europe in that season, but we were just flagging domestically. And to be honest, now when you look back, I mean, obviously Eto'o left under, you know, strange circumstances. He only come in the summer, then he left in the January. Now, it was, you know, there was rumours at the time, like, he'd have fallen out with Martinez. There was rumours that he'd told Lukaku he needed to leave. There was, you know, the official line was we wanted more first-team football. But I genuinely think, I mean, I don't know, it's just, you know, guessing, but maybe he was onto what we all learned about Martinez early on. Like, we obviously at that time, even though the domestic form had took a, you know, major wobble compared to the season before, we were all still quite high on Martinez at that point. And, you know, after the wonderful job he'd done the year before, so it was like, oh, well, Eto'o's obviously a troublemaker, and, you know, these star players come in, and, you know, sometimes they're like that. But I think he may have just seen through Martinez earlier than anyone, because this is a player who's played for the very best at the very best clubs. We just saw a joker when he saw one.
I think it's interesting, though, but obviously Eto'o was this superstar, but a player who actually proudly come out and said that he got zero international caps was Sylvain Distan, and he was another model professional who was forced out that season. So he can't have been the only one.
Yeah, I mean, it's come out now, hasn't it? You know, that Martinez was just not a very good man managing. Like, there was a lot of players he mistreated, and, you know, he had strange quirks, and, you know, he when the Moyes team sort of defensive structure had, you know, slipped away a little bit, that's when you saw what the making of him as a manager. But I don't know. I mean, Eto'o was just one of the biggest wastes. I mean, he was here so briefly. He was only here for a cup of coffee that everyone can just look back at the Burnley goals and the fact that he signed. It's just a fun little, you know, sort of little moment in the club's recent history. Like, it was good to sign a player like that, even though he didn't stay.
I think it was one of them, though. I think, like you say, it was disappointing, really, that even at that stage of his career, he could have probably given more to the team.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we for that season and maybe even the next, we could have used them properly. And I think under a better manager, we would have. Like, imagine, take that squad that we had then. Imagine we had Ancelotti managing that squad. How much different it would be. I mean, Ancelotti, obviously, he's got more experience of dealing with top players, but it just be such a different scenario. We'd be seeing Eto'o used correctly, and, you know, we'd probably do a lot better than we did when we had Martinez.
But if you ask me, we had Ancelotti at the time, we wouldn't have lost Lukaku, we wouldn't have lost players like that.
Well, it's a big what if, isn't
it? But I'm just convinced that you need to have these kind of ambitions, bringing in these kind of managers of that caliber to showed that you're moving in the right direction, and it was clear that maybe not to us, but maybe Samuel Eto, like you say, saw through him and knew that we weren't going anywhere under this manager.
I mean, in general, in a broad brushstroke, I am personally quite eager for the club to move away from these signs. Now, historically, we've always signed older players to see if we can get a tune out of them for the last few years. Like, you know, we've done it, you know, Gascoigne, Ginola, even Rooney up and, you know, recently. But Eto was not, I didn't feel like he was one of those, you know, finished players who we just brought in to see if we can get something. I felt like even though he wasn't an advanced age for the role we should have used them for, because it's not like we brought him in to be the main striker, which we hadn't done with other, you know, older signings. We brought him in to complement a young player and, you know, sort of improve them. And it's something we've still tried to do now. We tried to do it with Fabian Delph. Now, he hasn't worked out so far. But I'm look back fondly on Eto just because it was such a star name player to buy. And it was so unexpected to complement our brand new record signing, Lukaku. It's just an exciting time. You know, before you know what's going to happen down the line, it's, you know, that's the joy of football, isn't it? You know, the excitement, the anticipation of new players and how they're going to work together. It's just a shame we never got to see it used properly.
It was definitely a potential wasted there. Maybe not in terms of, obviously, the age of him and that, but it was certainly the opportunity that we had to pair two very good strikers together. Like, that doesn't really come along very often. And he was misused at the end of the day. And maybe, like you say, if he did stir things up in the camp, that may well have contributed to his early departure, which is highly likely when you consider that it did seem to happen on a number of occasions for Roberto Martinez. When I think, I don't recall the last couple of games he played for us. I seem to forget him even playing in the last sort of month he was here. I'm not sure if you have any recollection of that.
No, he played ahead of Tony Hibbert, didn't he, on a couple of it? Was it just the one occasion? I think I seem to remember he did it away at Lille. I went to that game. And that was just a bizarre sight. Down the right wing, Tony Hibbert and Samuel Eto'o, which is football throws up these strange things, doesn't it? Let's be honest.
I think the mad thing was, I don't remember Eto'o doing anything in that game, but I can remember Tony Hibbert doing a couple of drag backs, everyone losing the marbles.
Yeah. Tony Hibbert showing Eto'o, you know, the skills he hadn't seen since he was a lot better than Coutinho.
Get on this, Sam. Look at this. And then obviously, Samuel Eto'o, he did bring that European experience as well, which we never got to see much of, and it was a shame because we were going pretty good in Europe that season, and then obviously Kiev happened.
Kiev. Don't make me talk about Kiev.
We are going to talk about that. In fact, we're going to wrap it up here. So that brings us to the end of the Samuel Eto'o segment. It seems to be the general consensus here is just a missed opportunity, really, to get the best out of an aging yet still very talented player. I think that's probably a good way of wrapping it up, isn't it?
I'd say so, yeah. You know, exciting signing. It was good while it lasted, but ultimately misused and a missed opportunity by a manager we didn't know was crap yet.
look how that turns out. Teddy and I are here to kickstart our player review segments for this season. Of course, we know the season could still be resumed and completed, but at this stage, I think we can all agree any ending to this season is going to have a completely different feel to it to what came before. So we're going to crack on with it anyway. And we're going to start this series with our big Colombian, Yerry Mina. He's a player who was thrusted into the spotlight at the start of the season after we failed in our pursuit of Kurt Zouma. Mina was, of course, primarily a substitute during his first season at Goodison, but still did well when called upon. But this season saw the need for him to take on a lot more responsibility in the first team. And this show will hopefully discuss just how well he has handled the more prominent role that he was given in the team this year. So, Teddy, what have you made of Mina's performances this year?
They've been what I've expected, to be honest. I mean, we only saw him briefly last season. You know, the injuries sort of played a big part. We signed him injured. He got himself re-injured a couple of occasions, and then he couldn't get in the team due to the good form of Keane and Zouma. Now, we're going into this season. You know, obviously, we chased Zouma all summer and then, you know, didn't come off. And, you know, we know what happened there, you know, last minute loan deals going in for other players and what have you. So we started the season, and I had no concerns over Mina's ability. I just had concerns over his injury record, which, to be honest, was a sensible thing to think, because he is still quite young. He, you know, 22, maybe 23, we're at the start of the season. But he'd had all the season before basically out the team. When he had come in, he had played well. You know, the two games against Chelsea, which Zouma was ineligible for, Mina played well in both of those games. So I felt there was a good defender there. My issue was, which has been proven to be wrong, I was worried what would happen if one of them got an injury out of Keenan and Mina. I thought we've got no depth because I don't think Holgate's good enough, which he's probably proved me wrong on. Mina's got the physical ability in spades. He's a good big stopper of a defender. You know, he's powerful in the air. Unorthodox way of moving. Like, he sometimes just, you know, falls over and blocks, you know, shots on goal. Yeah, he's a strange one like that. But natural ability, I think he's got it. He's obviously, his brain sometimes abandons him. For me, I went into the season looking at him as our top defender because I had less doubts ability-wise over him than I did for Keane. Because although I've gone out and cold on Keane, I definitely felt that Mina was our strongest defender. And, I think on the strength of the whole season, I'd be right in writing my assessment. I think Mina's been one. He would be in there until very recently for a shout for our player of the season, until obviously the turnaround to form of some other players, you know, Holgate, Calvert-Lewin and what have you. But he's certainly the most consistent across the whole season, meaning I think he surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, I think during the early spell of the season when we were really poor under Silver, I think he was one of the few who could sort of walk out of it with his head held high. I think before Duncan Ferguson took over, he was probably one of the few with any sort of respectability from the early stages of this season. And obviously there's plenty we'd want to gloss over in that first couple of months of the season, but I do think he's got on. I do feel that since Ancelotti's come in, there's been a lot of rotation between the three centre-backs, hasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, more so than you'd expect. There was a lot of times where you go, oh, what's he dropped in for and all that. It just seems to be something Ancelotti does. You know, until the season stoppage, I definitely got the impression that he was having a good look at the players he had to see if he wanted to keep going forward, but he sort of landed on an unlikely but effective centre-back partnership of Holgate and Mina, because Holgate's pace and his ability on the ball allowed Mina to go into his more natural position. The right-hand side centre-back who goes to meet the ball, the dominant centre-back of the pair. And to be honest, Carragher, I hate to quote Carragher, but he got it right on Sky once. He said a lot of centre-back partnerships are like big brother, little brother. You know, like, one's physically more powerful and commanding and one is more of a footballer. And I think that is, you know, after a fashion, what we've got with Mina and Holgate. So now I think, you know, looking to go forward, I think Mina is up against Keane for that spot. I don't think Mina is up against Holgate. I think Holgate starts anyway. He's the only one who's appropriate for that position.
Certainly.
In the team of the ball playing centre-backs. But I think Mina is a long way ahead of Keane. When everyone's fit, I don't think Keane gets anywhere near the team over either of them.
Well, there you go. I think, I'll be honest, I don't want to be blow my own trumpet here because it's going to be one of them I like such and such before it was cool. But I thought when Mina first arrived, I was hoping that it would end up being a partnership between Mina and Holgate out of the four defenders we had. But obviously it turned out to be the other two, Keane and Zouma, who went on to be the main one. And I thought, oh, there's me with egg on my face. And then look what happens, what a difference a year makes.
Yeah, I mean, I won't lie. I was a Mason Holgate doubter for a long time. I felt like he could be a good right back, but not a centre back, and he's proved me wrong. But I was the opposite. I thought that Mina and Zuma would have been the ideal partnership because, you know, the combination of everything. But then they tried that once against Newcastle, and the game after the derby where Pickford dropped the ball. It was key. It was Mina and Zuma for that game and that game only as a partnership. And I don't think that meant that's it. They're not good enough. They can't, you know, they drew a home to Newcastle. They can't, you know, they can't play well together. But I would have, if we'd have got Zuma, I would have went into the season wanting that to be the centre back partnership personally. But whatever combination, I think for a lot of people, Mina was in it. I don't think anyone went to the season, very few at least, thinking Keane and Holgate will be our partnership.
Well, definitely. I think for me, it was more Holgate was the quickest than I was hoping that he'd kick on. And in fairness, he has now. But at the time, like maybe just over a year ago, it didn't look likely. And
no, you're right. Well, he's done well, hasn't he?
He's done very well. And of course, Yerry Mina's been, like you say, probably the main centre-back partner he's had. And we've been doing pretty well at the back since Carlo took over. Obviously, there's one game we've got to focus on since Carlo took over, and it's that game where he scored twice against Watford and goaded the fans. Apparently, he goaded the Watford fans with his dancing. And I mean,
when we signed him, everyone knew him as that Colombia defender who kept scoring headers at the World Cup. Then people saw that he dances whenever he scores, and he'd only scored against Burnley the season before, didn't he? And he only danced for like second. He had a goal ruled out this season for offside, and there was not offside, sorry, for a foul, and there was not.
I was at the West Ham game, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. And then obviously he scores two at Watford, and we finally get to see his dancing celebration because it was ruined at Burnley and it taken away from us against West Ham. So we've been waiting nearly 2 years to see Yerry Mina score a goal and start dancing. And mate, when he scores at Goodison, you know the roof's going to blow off because everyone's waiting for him to do it. You just know he's going to net at the street end and just start dancing in one of the corners, and everyone's going to be loving life.
If we ever get
back into stadiums, that is, if we ever go to Goodison again.
It's one of them. Of course, Yerry Mina, though, that I just remember him whining. There's a fan who gets really triggered by his dancing and like loses it in the post-match interview.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely hilarious, but it was one of those. He is a threat from set piece, and I don't think our set piece delivery is good enough, to be honest, to get the most out of him in that respect.
God knows why. It's just the case of Everton, isn't it? We've got Sigurdsson, who spent his whole career being excellent from set pieces, and now all of a sudden at Everton don't score off many set pieces. He hasn't scored a direct free kick yet, and Mina suddenly can't find the ball off corners. We're just cursed.
There must be some kind of Everton constant in there that tells every corner taker to hit the first man. But obviously, before we finish, Yerry Mina season review, what would you give him? What score out of 10?
I'd give him a 6 out of 10. That sounds like it's harsh, but I don't want to be going too mad and giving him higher than that. But I think he's been, you know, been okay. He's been above average, but doesn't set the world on fire. Because let's be honest, only one of two players have set the world on fire for the season.
I think he's
been the most consistent, but not the most exciting. I'd say it that way.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of putting it. I'd have gone with a similar score myself. So, yeah, that's kind of the general consensus, I think, on Mina's season. He's done pretty well, but like you say, he's a centre back. He's never going to set the world alight.
No, exactly. But he's done well. Been Mr. Consistent for the majority of the season compared to some of the other players. Even some of the better players for the season of year haven't been as consistent as him.
Certainly. But there you have it. That's the verdict on Yerry Mina for the season. That brings us to the end of this analysis. Teddy and I are going to do our second performance review of the squad for this season. If you've tuned into the Yerry Mina one, which we've already done, then you'll understand we're disregarding any potential ending to the season, should it resume given the considerable differences in circumstances. Be the first to focus on one of this season's new signings, Alex Iwobi. Iwobi was the last of our plethora of new arrivals last summer and came in for a tasty $35 million from Arsenal. I'm not going to lie, when I saw this was a going on deadline day, I was doing the live stream on the Toffee Blues YouTube channel and I was absolutely horrified that we were going to pay this kind of money. Nonetheless, he came in and he was expected to add some pace, power, a bit of skill to our attacking options. And having only turned 24 last week, there is still potential for him to grow as an Everton player. But nonetheless, we're still going to scrutinise him because that's what we do. Terry, how do you think Iwobi's first season at Goodison has gone?
It's a strange one, really, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned it there. You know, he was bought on deadline day and he seemed to have all the hallmarks of a panic buy. You know, we sold Adamola Lookman and not replaced his position in the squad. We'd been linked in the press with Wilfried Zaha for about a week and a half. You know, rumours of, you know, bids and then bids including swap deals and all that. And then out of nowhere, we're bidding for Alex Iwobi. Now, you've said 35 million. I'd seen that, you know, could rise to that kind of thing. And it's actually more like 27 million.
Even still, it's tasty, isn't it?
Still isn't great. Like, I mean, he was... It's a weird one because Iwobi, I think, you know, can be a good player. You know, his chance creation stats before he came to the club were quite good for Arsenal. Like, obviously, you know, assists and goals and all that, you know, not great. But he was an industrious, creative player. So you've got to remember as well, the sort of environment he was bought in. He was bought by Marco Silva, and Marco Silva religiously played 4-2-3-1. So I wonder whether he wasn't even bought to play wide, that he was bought to sort of add competition for Gylfie Sigurdsson, because Gylfie Sigurdsson is the number 10. After being bought with a plethora of number 10s, ended up being the only number 10, and he had no competition whatsoever. So now, obviously, we're playing Iwobi, you know, on either wing, and, you know, under Ancelotti and under Duncan Ferguson for a brief spell. But he was brought in with a different shape, a different team, and probably a different role in mind. And he started well. I mean, a lot of fans won't have been, you know, excited by him because it was a player that Arsenal fans didn't think was very good. Like, you know, Arsenal fans, he was a bit of a whipping boy for them. But then on the other hand, he could have been, you know, he was their academy product, could have been similar to, you know, us with Barkley. Like, some people overrated him.
Yeah, I think it was very similar to that, actually.
Some people overrated him in their fan base and some people underrated him. You know, it was hard to get a good picture of what he was actually like as a player because the, you know, opinions of fans is always a bit skewed for their own academy players, you know, either negatively or positively. But he came in, he started well. He scored against Wolves, scored against Lincoln, you know, headed goals, which he wasn't really known for. He started off well. And he was in the team. And I don't think anyone thought, I mean, I didn't personally think he was going to come in and replace Bernard, because Bernard was one of our better players from the season before. I genuinely thought he's going to come in and be competition slash a replacement for Sigurdsson, who's getting a bit older now. And the one time that he did actually, well, to tell a lie, the two times he actually did play that role of behind the striker, it was completely different. He would, you know, Sigurdsson was more, you know, was a statue in that number 10 position, would stand next to Calvert-Lewin, and Calvert-Lewin just, you know, wasn't getting any joy from that formation of the team. And then when Iwobi played, it was against West Ham, and he did it against Sheffield Wednesday as well.
That's right, yeah.
And he just, different dynamic to the team. You know, where Iwobi was travelling with the ball more than Sigurdsson does. You know, his movement off the ball was a lot better. He was creating space. And it's almost, you know, one of the victims of the change of formation, I think, will be Iwobi, because when he's going to play in that left-hand side role and compete with Bernard, and he's not going to get the freedom to move about that he would have had in a number 10 position, but I don't see us going back to that. So I think he's been sort of, you know, lost between the lines. And I mean, his injury hasn't helped. Since he's come back from the injury, he's not been very good. You know, he's not been terrible, but he's not been very good. And it's led to a lot of people sort of writing him off and
definitely,
you know, thinking he's worse than he probably is. But it's whether he can... The gauntlet's been laid down to him now. He needs to carve himself out of position in this team, no matter where it is. If he thinks his best position in this formation is going to be that sort of left-hand side, you know, tucked-in wide player role that Bernard's been playing, it's wide open for him because Ancelotti doesn't seem, for whatever reason, stuck on Bernard
now.
Yeah, yeah. Doesn't seem like he's as convinced as on Bernard as the supporters are. So Iwobi's got a chance. If when you know, we're doing the season reviews now, because when it comes back, it's going to be like another mini-season, isn't it? It's not going to feel like the same season. It's going to have its own pre-season and everything. So Iwobi needs to treat this as, I'm going to use these 9 games, I'm going to get in the team, you know, if they do play, that is. And I'm going to, you know, put my marker down. I've been given a sort of little mini-blessing because I've managed to get myself back up to the same speed as everyone else now because everyone's been off.
That's it, yeah. And again, I think, like you say, it's, these are the kinds of issues you end up having when you have to sack managers on the regular, like we have been doing. You get players who were signed by previous management who now have a difficulty fitting into the new manager's system.
And yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely the biggest casualty of that, like you say.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. He was a panic buy. He was bought for a position we don't play anymore. And he's always, you know, been hot and cold in his career. There's been, you know, supporters of Arsenal loved him and supporters of Arsenal who hated him. And I think it's going to be the same with Everton. There'll be a lot of people who'll never be convinced by him. Something I've made my mind up pretty early on is he can't play on the right.
That's very, very certain to me. He was appalling when he played there.
Yeah, but possibly on that left-hand side with him, Luca Dean overlapping him, there's a chance for him to play there. You know, he's still young. He's, you know, we could get, you know, some money back for him if we, you know, if Ancelotti decided he wasn't going to use him, but I don't think we will. I think next season could be a watermark season for him, where he a watershed, I don't know, whichever that would, water something.
Watershed, the one I think you're trying to get at.
No, watermark, something put on a Photoshop artwork, isn't it? Could be a big season for him. Because, you know, obviously this season's been interrupted by injury and then latterly the coronavirus. But he did start okay. You know, scored goals, impressed in his number 10 position, but now the challenge is there. You've moved to another club from your boyhood club. You need to, you know, really establish yourself now. You're not going to get any favours.
That's it, definitely. And, I mean, what do you think the future holds for Iwobi then? What do you think he'll do next season? Is there a place for him or... I mean, I think he'll still be here next season, that's for sure. But what happens beyond that? Do you think he's got an opportunity? Will he take it to sort of re-establish himself on the wing or in centre mid or something? Or do you think he's that adaptable?
I think if we stick with this formation, he's only got one chance, and it's in that left-hand side, tucked in position there that Bernard's been playing. Because as good as Bernard is, manager doesn't seem to be as struck on him as we are. And Iwobi's got a chance to get in there. And it's the only position in a 4-4-2 that will suit him because he's not going to play centre midfield. He's certainly not going to play wide right and he's not going to play up front. So if he doesn't get any games there, he's going to be that position that Adam Ola-Luckman found himself in of just being one of the substitutes every week and comes in to shore the game up or see if he can, you know, make something happen. But he's got the tools, physically strong, you know, a good footballer on his day, but just needs to prove it consistently because as many games as good games.
He's only turned 24 last week. I mean, he's still a young player, like you say, plenty of potential. It's all on him, really, if he wants to fulfil it at Everton.
Yeah, true. It is. It's, you know, I don't think we're going to be looking to sell him because our transfer fees are going to be, you know, deflated when transfers do end up happening again. So we take a loss on him at the minute. So I think we probably will stick with him. I think Bernard and Iwobi are going to spend all next season fighting for that same shirt. But other places in the team are going to be a little bit easier to get into. But Iwobi, I don't think, suits any others, which is unfortunate for them.
It's one of them, I think. Obviously, the pressure is very much on him to establish himself now and the jury's still out from both fans and manager at this stage, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, hasn't had much of a crack under Ancelotti because he'd only just come back from injury before the virus. He'd, you know, started at Watford and didn't seem fit, but he did okay. And after that, you know, he's come in here and there. But I think it'd be very interesting to see whether Ancelotti uses him once everyone's back and more or less everyone's fit.
Yeah, so obviously we're going to conclude here. What would be your score out of 10 for Iwobi's performance this season?
5. I mean, it's you know, I gave Yerry Mina a 6, and I feel harsh with that now since I'm giving Iwobi a 5. But yeah, I think he's been good enough. You know, he's too good for a 4, not good enough for a 6. I just think, you know,
yeah, that's spot on. I think that's exactly what I'd have gone with myself. So
if he hadn't got injured, I think we could have, you know, decided either way. But I don't think he's played enough games to really go either way.
Certainly, I think that's, like I say, the jury's still out, and I think that's probably the general consensus at the moment that moving forward, I think if you ask so many people how his season's gone, his first season at Everton, I think everyone would say it's been a stop-start season, middle of the road, and a 5 out of 10 is pretty much justified.
Yeah, I mean, if we do manage to play these 9 games, we'll do another mini-season review.
Yeah,
and hopefully,
we'll do it. It's the post-season review.
Yeah, hopefully much better.
Hopefully for everyone, of course, 9 games maybe to give us a bit of a lift, and you know, it might be better than we expect. But there you have it. That's the verdict on Alex Iwobi from Terry and I. 5 out of 10. That brings us to the end of the season review for Alex Iwobi. And for our podcast listeners, thank you for tuning in as well. Unfortunately, we haven't got any quiz to finish off this week. So that means it was up to our very own Terry to pick what song he wanted to finish off on. And on Terry's request, we're going to finish this week with The Land of Confusion by Genesis, a pretty fitting song for the current scenario. So there you have it, a brilliant choice from Terry, if you'd ask me. And you'll get to enjoy Genesis to see us out at the end of the show. So thank you guys for tuning in on the Soccer Blues.